You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Okay, now back with me here on Next on the Tee is Bob Byman. Bob is from Poughkeepsie, New York. He played his college golf at Wake Forest, where he lettered all 4 years from 1973 to 1976. He was named All-American 3 times and All-ACC 2 times. He helped the Demon Deacons to back-to-back national championships in 1974 and 75. His 73.25 career stroke average is still one of the tops in school history. He tied for first at the 1974 ACC Championship, and he finished second the following year behind teammate Curtis Strange. He also took medalist honors at the 1974 Furman Intercollegiate Tournament, the 1975 Iron Duke Intercollegiate Tournament, and the 1976 Duke Spring Invitational. He turned pro in 1976. Bob played a ton of golf over on the European Tour and had a great deal of success over there. In 1977, he won 3 national opens in Sweden, Holland, and New Zealand, and finished 5th on the European Order of Merit. He would go on to win the Dutch and Scandinavian Opens twice, including in 1978 by 1 stroke over Nick Price. Earned his PGA Tour card in 1978. He won the Bay Hill Invitational in 1979 in a playoff over John Schrader. Later in 79, he would finish tied for 7th at the Open Championship at Royal Lytham in St. Anne's. By 1985, he started turning his attention to teaching the game. Bob is now a wonderful golf instructor at a golf school out in Las Vegas, and I'm very excited he is back with me again on Next on the Tee. Hey, Bob, thanks for coming back on the show.
Absolutely, Chris. Pleasure being with you.
Bob, I wanted to start our time today by talking about your transition from playing out on the PGA Tour to being one of the top instructors in the game now. What was that transition like for you?
Well, it was quite a challenge because, you know, as a professional golfer, you're on your own. Everything is in your world. And you're doing everything for yourself. It's dictated to play, at a very, very high level that you're quite a selfish guy. And of course, teaching, you have to be completely selfless because you are there for the student and their benefit. So it took a little bit of time to adjust to that. I would say, a year or two before I really got, the hang of it. And you mentioned that I got started in teaching around 1987, actually started in 1985. By the time I, 1987 came around, I had some really nice, positions, and locations that I was teaching at, and it really started to develop, then. So, one of the things that helped me as well was that I was, I played a lot of sport and a lot of team sport, baseball, football, basketball. So I think that helped me, as well to make the adjustment over time because, as a student teacher relationship becomes, a team situation. So, I made the adjustment and have done very, very well.
Bob, like I mentioned in your intro, Wake Forest, you guys won back-to-back national championships in 74 and 75. Young kids dealing with a lot of mental pressure at that level. I kind of want to talk about how you, now when you get a young player in,
that is competing at the highest levels, at the, whether it's AJGA or at the college level, or even for those of us that are trying to go out and win our club championships. How do you help people deal with the kind of pressure that they're not used to?
Well, you know, the ability to play at a high level, let's say whatever stage you are and whatever environment you're in, you know, you're never going to play better than the wildest imagination that you have for yourself. Okay. So I tell everybody to dream big and imagine yourself in these situations long before you get there. So a lot of this is, you know, your ability to actually see yourself in these future situations. And, of course, it comes out in a positive manner. So, you know, to get there, you know, you have to do the work. You have to have the, you know, the physical component. You know, I call those time-tested fundamentals. You have to be able to know how to play the game. And that generally has four components. You know, in every successful shot that you play, you have to see the shot before you actually execute it. So there's an image that you have to have of the successful shot. And then you have a feeling, I call it feelmagery, of the motion that you need in order to create the image that you have. Then you have to be able to set up so that you can actually perform the feelmage. Okay. And then you have some kind of a thought, either it's an attitude or an emotion, or it can be as simple as, okay, you can do it, let it go. Or, you know, you can have, thoughts inside of your golf swing. And we can talk further about that as we go on. But, there's a physical, there's a mental, and then you go ahead and you have to be a great evaluator. So as soon as you're able to anticipate your result to some level, then you have the ability to actually plan your roundup and plan what you're about to do during each individual hole and then in each individual shot. And as soon as you can plan, then you can manage. And as you manage your shot, you create the result, and then you have an evaluation period, and then you assess it. If it's what you want, you keep going. If it's not what you want, then you make an adjustment and go on from there. And you just keep going until, the round is completed or the tournament is completed. So, you know, all of these things are like a big funnel of acceptability, a funnel of parameters. So, you know, to shoot 100, the parameters, the funnel is very wide, let's say up at the top. And as you get lower and lower and lower down into the, you know, let's say top 10 in the world, the parameters of acceptability in the physical, mental, and then raising the level of your game area is very, very narrow. And that's why you see the greatest players, the historically great players of all time, have very, very similar things that they have done. They've expressed them differently because they all have different bodies and temperaments and all that stuff. But they all generally do the same thing. So if you stay within that, you have the opportunity to create your optimal ability of play. So, we work on all things depending on where the level of the golfer is and what he wants for himself or herself. So as you get better, many times, you know, as a teacher, I'm one thing. We give you information and we try to work that into your game. But as your coach, then, some of these things I take on, you know, sometimes a John Wooden attitude and sometimes a Bobby Knight attitude, depending on the student and what they need at that particular time to reach the goals that they want.
So, Bob, talk about how that manifested itself in you and how you're able to bring that out of yourself and your experiences. Because I got to imagine at some point you're a really good high school player who now has an opportunity to go play at Wake Forest, which has a tremendous golf history. And then from there, you're beating Nick Price by a stroke. And from there, you're playing at Bay Hill in front of Arnold Palmer, who, oh, by the way, you got a scholarship. You got the Arnold Palmer scholarship to go play it at Wake Forest. So now you're playing in front of that guy in the first year of his sponsorship or hosting, if you will, the Bay Hill Invitational. And then the next thing you know, you're on the tee with Jack Nicklaus at Augusta National. How did you manifest all of that through yourself to be okay, to be able to play and execute in those kinds of situations?
That's a great question. And, you know, how do you become, a really good player? I was an excellent athlete. I played all sports. If I hadn't played golf, I probably would have gone into baseball and would have tried to play professionally there. But, I had a physical skill and, my work, my practice, my mental energy as a junior golfer kept getting reinforced because I won a lot, and then was able to win the USGA Junior and, a number of top, junior events at that period of time, won my state amateur a number of times. So I was feeling quite confident about myself. And, Curtis Strange and myself were, recruited at the same time to go to Wake Forest. I was ranked the number one recruit. He was number two. So, getting to Wake Forest was fabulous. And when I got there, I realized that, Curtis was there. I didn't know he was there until almost nearly when I got there. And then, of course, Jay Haas was there and a guy named David Thor and, a few other guys that could really play. And you could see that we had the opportunity to be the best team in the country. And none of us really thought that much differently about it at that point. So, did we all get nervous naturally for competition? Yes. But to win the national championship the first time, Curtis had to come through in the last round to make a putt or two at the end. We won. The second time we won, we just dominated. So we just felt like we were the best. Like I mentioned earlier, you're never going to perform better than your wildest dreams. So we thought that we could dominate in that second year because we were, we're defending champions and all of us were playing pretty well going into that event. So, and then we did, Jay Haas actually won the event. Curtis finished third. I finished fourth. It was incredible. 1-3-4 finish. Jerry Pate was second for that event. So that just led you into, future things. In 1976, that summer, I played very, very well in amateur golf, won the Northeast Amateur and another, finished high in almost every, major amateur event that I played in. And then I turned pro and then finished second in my first event. So it was just a natural thing. I did not qualify for the tour in 1976, which brought me back to reality a little bit. And that was fortunate because that laid the groundwork to play over in Europe. So, but I went over to Europe to play and, was still very, very confident. I was the winner in amateur golf and junior golf. So I was used to winning and was able to pull off a couple wins in the first 5 or 6 weeks that I was over there. Got to play, right next to Seve Ballesteros and Greg Norman and a number of, Hugh Baiocchi, a number of really, very, very good players. And of course, a number of these guys, Seve and Greg, became, you know, just fantastic golfers. So it gave me a lot of confidence. And then that natural progression of ability to play and get comfortable in higher pressure situations led me to the winning at the Bay Hill Classic in 1979, and that was really probably the pinnacle. I didn't know it was going to be my pinnacle at that point, but it probably was. It was the greatest ball striking week that I had, and I was able to pull that off. You know, I played quite nicely at the British Open in 1978. I think I finished 16th or 17th. Played with Seve the last round, but I got within three shots the last round, of course, the tournament. Nicklaus won that tournament. And then 1979, I played a little bit better. I was third with like five holes to go and did not play particularly well at the end. That was at Royalton and St. Anne's. The wind was really whipping. Those last five holes are, you know, very, very tough. I finished seventh. So I, you know, it was very, very good. And, you know, as time went on, my physical fundamentals started breaking my body down. I was looking for help and, to really allow me to be everything that I could be in my own mind. And that I needed to make some physical adjustments in my swing, but I really couldn't get the information. Really wasn't available back then. So I did the best I could, but it was really, you know, I was really off the tour in any world-class manner, by 1984. So, you know, a lot of these things are just a lot of hard work, a good bit of talent, and doing what I said. I was fabulous at the mental side of the game and dealing with the ability to play each individual shot. I did that to a very, very high level. There were only, you know, the top players on the planet that were able to do that a little bit better than me. But, you know, I was able to beat them every once in a while, and that was a lot of fun.
No doubt. And I certainly want to get more into the mental approach and the technical aspects of the swing. But before we get off your career, you win Bay Hill. You are an Arnold Palmer scholarship player at Wake Forest. His first year is hosting the golf tournament. What was it like for you? And you talk about that being the pinnacle, and I could see, you know, based on everything that you've talked about so far, why that would be. But what was it like for you to stand next to the king and have sort of your career bubble up to this crescendo and have the king hand you the trophy for the tournament he's hosting?
You know, that's very interesting. You know, you're diving into this a little bit. That actually goes back to 1972. I was 17 years old. I qualified for the U.S. Open in Colorado, went through the local and sectional qualifies, won the sectional qualifying. And of course, that was in 1972. That was at Pebble Beach. That was Jack Nicklaus won that. And Arnold actually finished third. So I'm at Pebble Beach trying to get a practice round under my belt. And I think this was on it was either on a Tuesday or Wednesday. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure it was on a Tuesday. And of course, I didn't have a tee time. Didn't know you had to have a tee time. So my caddy and my father went up to the starter and said, you know, my son is here playing, you know, he'd like to play. And, you know, he said, well, wait, we'll put you in somewhere. So half an hour went by. There's nobody, like, there's no gallery around the first tee. If you ever been there, it's kind of a small area. And then all of a sudden it was 10 deep. And my caddy comes back to me and says, we're ready to go. So I go, oh my goodness, what is on the other side of all these people? I walk up onto the first tee. And Arnold Palmer was there, Julius Boros, and another one of his friends you wouldn't probably recognize. So I got to play in a practice round with Arnold and Julius.
Wow.
At the beach. So That was the most nervous I have ever been at any time in my, competitive career on that first tee. Cause Arnold, like, why don't you go ahead, kid? Go ahead and hit it first. And,
wow.
I could barely get the ball on the tee.
No doubt.
And look, that was the most simple my game, like, ever was. I was really hitting it well. And, I was able to actually concentrate to the degrees to make contact pretty well. And I hit the ball out in the right rough. And I was like, oh my goodness, I hit it. And, I was going to step off and Arnold throws down another ball and says, hit another one. So, okay. And I hit the same. I pushed it into the right rough, about 5 yards into the right rough, 6 yards into the right rough. And I hit the next ball like 2 feet from that one. It was the exact same one. I hacked that out. Got it on just short of the green. I think I three putted. So I made 6 on the first hole. From then on, I never missed a fairway and never missed a green. Made 3 birdies, shot 71. And it was the finest round I will ever play. In my future, I would ever play on a U.S. Open golf course. Wind was blowing 15, 20 miles an hour. It was about 55 degrees. And I made like a 20, 25 footer on the last hole to make birdie. And Arnold goes, wow, son, you can certainly stand on your own 2 feet. We shook hands. I went to the practice putting green afterwards. And Arnold was there. And he mentioned, he says, wow, I was really impressed by what you did today. Have you ever thought about Wake Forest University? And I said, no, I haven't. He says, well, I want you to think about that, and I will put a good word in there for you. And that's how that happened. And so,
amazing.
So when I was recruited by Wake Forest and Jesse Haddock, I went and visited, told him that story. He says, I know about that. Arnold had called me. And that's why I reached out to you, and I got along with Jesse very, very well. And that's how all that happened. And then, we did nicely at Wake Forest. The next time that I saw Arnold was on the, Wednesday, maybe Tuesday of Bay Hill Week. And I was playing a practice round with Curtis and Jay and my brother. And we were on the tee waiting on the first tee at Bay Hill, and Arnold and Jack come up on the tee. Like they're going to play behind us. And, wind was blowing into you on 18 on that day. So it was a tough day. Indy on one, second shot on 18 too. And, I think I hit 17, 16, 17, maybe, I don't know, 18 greens. Fabulous round. One of the best rounds I've ever played. Shot 67. Just, killed all the guys in the game. But on the first tee, of course, those guys, Nicklaus and Palmer, got up on the tee, and I was, oh my God, oh my God. And I just ripped it off of that tee. And it was like, man, you're ready. This is going to be your week. And of course, as you can have those thoughts, but you have to have, it has to keep being reinforced. And the physical manifestation of my thinking and my play was reinforced enough. I was leading into the last day, tied after the, 72 holes and then won on the second, playoff hole. So, and then of course, Arnold gives me the trophy at the end. It was like, holy moly. Well, what a great. I thought that was going to be another little stepping stone for me, but it ended up being really the culmination of all my hard work. I really never felt that well again physically. Just the health of my body and then how everything together, the physicality, the attitude, the focus, and the ability to play. You look back, that was the best I was able to do.
Well, it's pretty darn amazing story, pretty darn special experience. And a lot better than 99.9 of us will ever get to experience. So that's a fantastic story.
Yeah.
Bob, let's get back into the mental aspect of the game. Talk about what mind mapping is.
Well, mind mapping is, I can compare that to describe what it is. I'll compare what we generally do in the West here. When we're organizing data, we start up on the top left of a page and go left to right, up to down, and we write our information. Okay, so mind mapping is you organize your central idea and you have a big piece of paper and you put that in the middle of the page. And then every idea that comes off of is more specific is like a vein of thought, a vein of understanding away from that central locus point. And you can get as detailed as you want to be. So you start with the trunk of the tree and then you go out to the trunk separates a little bit and then you get to bigger and bigger branches and then smaller and smaller branches. And then you get to the leaves and the tips of the leaves and you can go as deep as you want to go. But so I do that with all my students. Generally, until you get down into, shooting in the mid-70s, it's fairly basic stuff. It's fairly basic. It's just doing it better and better and better. But as you get into the world-class play, now an awareness and understanding of some of these things that are out on the smallest branches and out on the leaves and the tips of the leaves are important to understand. Now, if you go out as a teacher, me, a teacher, coach, and you pull somebody out and they're shaking their head up and down, I understand, I understand, I understand. And then all of a sudden they look at you with a blank stare or their head is like going left and right. You know, you've gone at that particular moment in time a little bit too far for them. So all I do is I just compress it down. And sometimes you have to compress it down back into the center of the mind map, where the most basic stuff is. So we're always pulsing out for greater and greater awareness and understanding. If things get too much for a player, you just compress it back down to the most basic stuff and you start again. And you try to find out what kind of, thought pathways, work you into these understandings. And you see if, okay, that's too much for me. I come back. You go down that pathway again of thought and idea. And all of a sudden, like, you can't get out there again. So you have to compress it back to get out there a different way. So good players have the ability to find their best awareness and best play in a multitude of ways. And that's very, very important. I always, took to heart, Jack Nicklaus's attitude about going and becoming a player. In the end, you got to figure it out. You have to be able to figure it out on your own out there. Because in the end, it's you and your club and the golf ball and the course and whatever situation you're in. So not everybody is playing their best all the time. You have to understand these things and how to come back to the central ideas and then work your way out again and work through these things so that you can figure it out during a round of golf. So, I don't know that the players have that attitude so much today because they're used to having others, available for them to give them their ideas, like their caddy and their teacher and all that stuff. So, although, my business is predicated on me being there to help them to do it, but I take them down a pathway of being self-sufficient enough so that they can figure it out when they're on the golf course, when they're under pressure, coming down the last 9 holes or the last 3 holes or the last shot of the day or the last putt of the day. So, you know, mind mapping is a fabulous way to organize data. Fabulous way. And I use it very, very often.
So, Bob, let's take that a step further. Talk about what layering and time sequence focus are.
Well, a lot of times when you, well, let's see, how would I go about explaining that the best way for you? Let's describe this way. When I work with a student, you know, I've watched them hit three or four balls, and you know, I get a picture of what their ideal motion would be, and what it would be, and it's like a sculptor seeing the angel, the perfect angel inside of the block of granite, and then he takes away the marble to allow everybody else to see the angel. Okay. So I see the perfection of what they're about to do. And then we begin. Well, you can't do this. So you have to make that adjust or that adjust or that adjust. So in the beginning, I look for individual skills. If I ask you to do one thing, let me see if you have enough awareness and ability to do that one thing. Okay, so now I've seen that. And now then I ask for another individual skill, and then another and another. All these things are interrelated, but I don't want to overwhelm the student with multiple things to consider it at one time. Now, once we're able to do those individual things on a fairly regular basis, then we start putting we pair these things off. And that would be the ability to layer these things on each other, to pair them off and use 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever they are. You have a concept of them. They're so ingrained in your mind that you can think about these things in very small units of time. And they become layered together in one concept often. And we can go further into that, but, you know, so layering is the ability to take individual ideas, organize them in a sequential time sequence manner, and then apply those to either your learning or your ability to play. And that leads you into, time sequence focus. You know, when I grew up, playing and my experience in golf, you know, Jack would say, well, in interviews, while I was able to say, you know, thinking about this in my, starting position. And then in the swing, I thought about something in the beginning of the swing, something in the transition, you know, something, you know, through the ball and then whatever. So it's like he had 5, 6 things that he was considering for each individual shot. And as a young golfer, it's like, man, how do you do that all at the same time? Like holding those 6 things. Yeah, you know what the order is, but I found out over time that they aren't at the same time. They're at different times in the swing. So once you have a, make sure your alignment's good, make sure your grip is good, make sure your posture is good, whatever it is. That's like check, check, check when you're about ready to fly a plane. Now you get into the swing, not fly the plane. Okay, what do I have to do? Okay, I have a little idea in the beginning of my swing. Next, that's checked off now. Now in the trim, make sure I start down with a motion over to my left foot or whatever the case may be for that particular time. So you organize your mind so that you can focus in a time sequential manner that allows you to perform, execute the shot that you want to do. So that can be a variety of different things to focus in on. Sometimes, under the greatest degree of stress, most players have something in their starting position and like one thing in their swing. Or one thing in the load, one thing in the unload. I find that the best players of all time were able to do more than that. And the reason they were able to do more than that is because their awareness was so great that a little thought was enough to trigger a physical motion or a physical attitude during the swing inside of the whole of the 2 second swing that you're able to do. So the more aware you are, you can break these awarenesses down into milliseconds. You know, most of the students that I teach in the beginning, if I can get them to think about one thing during a 2 second time frame inside of their golf swing, that's really good. A high level tour player, he could think of, I don't know, 100, 1,000 time frames of one thing. I mean, it happens like in one, you know, little flash of time, and he can put those things together or see it as an overall flow. So you can pulse back and forth between the very, very specific to the very, very general. And really, the game dictates your ability to do this kind of stuff as you want to be better and better and better. The ability to have time sequence focus and the ability to layer your skills into one thing is a skill that, you know, every top player has. And as you get down, you know, from a 20 handicap down to a 10, down to a 3, down to a plus 2, plus 5, and then plus 8 like a tour player, that ability is dictated to you. If you're unable to do that, then at some point the game like stops you. That's like you've reached your optimal performance, and that there's nothing wrong with that. That's why it's not that easy to be great at anything. But that is a dictated thing from the game.
So Bob, let's talk about that for those of us that come out and we come see you in Las Vegas at your school. How do you go about assessing what you need to teach us?
Well, I'll tell you what I've put together over time, and I didn't have this in the very, very beginning. It took me a few years to put some of these things together. I call them time-tested fundamentals. I trademarked the term time-tested fundamentals. So, you know, I wanted to be the best player in the world. You know, that 1 week at Bay Hill, you could argue that maybe I was the best player in the world at that 1 week. But overall, I was probably top 20. That was probably my best. So that means there's, you know, 18, 19, 20 guys that can beat me regularly week after week after week. And I was not satisfied with that at all. So I started looking at the commonality of all of the greatest players. So in golf, in professional golf, 6 majors or more, and you are a historically great player. We've allowed some of the 5 guys in there. Seve was in there, Seve Ballesteros, Peter Thompson. Phil Mickelson was in that group until he won the PGA last year. He's 6, so he's in the six or better group now. But all of these guys ended up doing 99% of all of the same things. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been able to be historically great over an extended period of time. So what I did is I synthesized all these commonalities and I put them together as what I call time-tested fundamentals. So when someone comes to me, I always interview them. Tell me about your game. What issues do you have? Why aren't you playing better than you currently are? What do you want out of our time together? I always, almost always ask this one question. If our time together works out perfectly, what would happen? So then I get an idea of what they want to accomplish. And most of the time that is a good bit less than we eventually end up doing. So anyway, all these things that I get a picture of what, after seeing a few swings, of what this person is able to do. With, if we improve their flexibility, if we improve their, suppleness, if they, you know, if I'm able to harness their agility, get them into balance, then all of a sudden their shots will take on a repetitive manner and they'll be able to anticipate their results. So generally I start with how someone puts their hands on the club. Now, if you look at any, of the greatest, players' books that they've written, the grip is like one of, if not the first thing that they always talk about. And frankly, if you're unwilling to put your hands on in a manner that is whatever, 95%+ of what the greatest players in the, of history have done, you are not going to allow yourself to go down the most effective pathway of learning. So I generally start with the grip, starting position, loading motion, unloading motion, finish, the whole thing. And then we work more specifically. But I don't always do that with people. A lot of times you get something that is so against their goals that we work on that first. Like, you know, someone is, you know, they're hitting behind the ball, they're topping, they're sculling, and they're finishing with, you know, 70-80% of their weight on their right foot at the finish for a right-handed golfer. So I might, with that person, hey, well, wait a minute now, let's, do you know how to throw a ball? So they throw the ball and it's like, man, you got like a two handicap throw. All your weight went to your left foot. And why do you do that? Well, I try to keep my head down or whatever. You start trying to figure out where their swing came from, what they've been thinking about, what they've been taught, because the swing that they're bringing me is based on their belief system, what they've trained themselves to do, and their physical ability. So I very often will get somebody to just go to the finishing position and actually finish like a golfer. And then we come back to the starting position and then maybe we go to the grip. So that's kind of the fun of teaching for me. I never know exactly what I'm going to tell a person in order, but it always ends up being the same stuff. There's, depending on how you organize the time-tested fundamentals, there are, you know, I generally put them in the eight. There are eight of them. And I just go around that circle again and again and again, picking things off until you're able to do all eight of them. If you can do all eight of them, you're generally a person that can shoot in the 70s with, I would say, average athletic ability and an ability to focus pretty well, and you work on it. So, I've done some pretty amazing things with, you know, 20, 25 handicaps becoming mini tour, winners and, young kids, they cry during their first lesson and they become a U.S. amateur champion and a PGA Tour winner. You know, so it's just absolutely incredible what this stuff does. I don't see it out there, in the teaching world. It's reproducible for myself and for the student, and it's worked very, very well.
So let's take that a half step further, Bob, because you wrote a book titled The Absolute Best Grip in the World, How to Finally Take Control of Your Golf Game. Talk about what the best grip in the world is. Is it the same for all of us?
Well, again, it depends on what you want. You know, the best players that have ever played have had their hands, the most basic relationship of the hands are the palms facing each other. The palms are also in the same line as the leading edge of the club face. The palms of the hands are perpendicular to the body alignment. Okay, so that's the relationship that just about everyone, actually Lee Trevino was the only aberration there. In his prime, his left hand was a little stronger than that. His right hand was perfect. But I always found it interesting as a young player, and then as a teacher looking at this stuff, you know, what to really teach people. You know, the best grip I've ever seen was Hogan. Now, okay, so, well, he's the best ball striker ever. Well, the second best grip I've ever seen was Jack Nicklaus. Oh, well, he's the best player ever. Oh, well, you know, Sam Snead is the third best grip I've ever seen. And at that point, he had won more tournaments than anybody else. So you go, really, do I need to know anything else? Do I need to know anything besides? And then you go, you start looking at some of the other male and female people that have just dominated the sport in their day and became historically great players. And they all did basically the same thing. So when the hands become the club face, now all of a sudden the club face is wherever the hands are during the swing. So if it starts in a square position, it will, if the grip is maintained, the club face will always be square to the hand during the swing. So over time, everybody reacts to that relationship of the hand to the club face. Now, if let's say the hands are both rotated to the right, the left hand is, the palm of the hand is facing down the ground, the palm of the right hand is facing up, which would be commonly known as a stronger grip. If you come into impact and don't influence how the hands come back through the ball, the palms of the hands always want to finish straight up and down, vertical to the ground coming into impact. So if you start with your hands rotated to the right, the club face is always going to tend to come in slightly close. So if that person swings naturally, that person will always hook the ball. So he's going to have to make adjustments inside of his swing to get the club face to come back to square. Person has both his hands rotated the other way, so the palm of the left hand is facing to the sky a bit and the palm of the right hand is down. That club face, the palms are always going to come back straight up and down. That club face is always going to be open. So that person is always going to tend to slice the ball. So that person's going to end up, he's going to be swinging left. He's going to aim left. So because the ball is always going to be curving to the right, and he's going to get into that groove of understanding of the game. And without actually changing how the grip goes on to the club, that person will never actually make that adjustment over time. He might have a little tip or something to do it on a short-term basis, but long-term, it'll never happen. So if you really want to be the best that you can be and see what your optimal performance is, the game, again, dictates these things to you. You have to have a grip that will allow you to go down a path of least resistance in learning. So once you do that, then thing. Okay, well, at least I got one thing good. I got my grip and the club face in a relationship that is like the greatest players of all time. Anybody can do that. It takes no talent, takes a lot of work, takes a lot of perseverance to make it yours. But that leads you down a path of a proper starting position, and then that encourages the loading motion to be good, which encourages the unloading motion to be proper, which would get you into the finishing. And all these things, they just, the dominoes start to fall. So again, do you have to start with the grip? No, but if the form of everything else is in a world-class manner, if your grip is too strong, you're going to be fighting a hook. If the grip is too weak, you're going to be fighting a fade or a slice. And the game will bring you back to, oh, well, that son of a gun, that guy was right. So generally, I start there, and then we move on. Now, you know, the book that I wrote is the most detailed literary piece ever written about how to create a world-class grip. And I wrote that for anybody who wants to be their absolute best. And for, you know, for someone like myself, you know, as a young kid growing up, is there a blueprint for greatness? So, man, if you could just put a good athlete, young kid, whatever, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, and this kid has a world-class grip, he will generally figure out most of the other stuff that needs to be done for him to excel in the game. But, it works. I've had 85-year-old students, and it works from the youngest all the way to the oldest. And, the outcomes are so fantastic and very often so surprising to the student. I had no idea. No one's ever paid any attention to this. And we do it together. And, short-term improvement is almost always quite dramatic, but really more importantly, we lay the foundation for their continued improvement over time.
All right. So now I'm going to get personal with you for my golf swing based on what I just heard you say, and I want to give a visual for our listeners. As I grip the golf club and I'm a right-handed player, my left hand, I typically see 2.5, maybe 3 knuckles, and then I overlap, and then I've got the little, my right index finger is sort of like outspaced, got some space between my right index finger and my right middle finger, sort of like in a trigger. But give us a visual. What, if I'm looking down the golf, looking straight down at my grip, what should I see?
Well, I would, Chris, let's hit some ball. Show me what you got. Okay? Show me what you got.
I'm a pull hooker. That's my problem. If I have a miss,
well, there you go.
I'm pull hooking.
Oh, so I guess maybe, you heard what I said. You go, really?
Yep.
Is that why I hook? I thought
right.
I like came over the top. I thought I did this. I thought I didn't start down. Blah, 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 blah. You're in the world of golf in a different way, but you must love the game.
I do.
I'm pretty sure you've played and practice a lot. So if your belief system was correct and you did the right thing, I don't think you would be fighting a pull hook. So you go, okay, if that's what is, why do you think you hooked the ball? Well, then they go, well, I come over it, I blah, blah, whatever the case may be, and they never go to the root cause. So, if your left hand is rotated a bit strong, and your right hand fits in, I would think that the palm of your right hand is facing a little bit to the sky. Is that correct?
I don't think so. I think I've got it, kind of perpendicular, and it's in the same position that you mentioned with the club face. It's just my left hand is rotated strong.
And you're right-handed?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So your right hand, if your right hand dominates and the left hand just lays long and doesn't do that much, your right hand would bring the club face back to square to some degree. So I can't imagine that you hook it all the time. So you go,
not all the time. That's my miss.
Yeah, that's your miss. So anybody in the history of the game that had their left hand too strong, the left hand always, the hand always wants to come back to vertical through impact, naturally. So the most natural golf swing, the most under pressure you are, physics tends to take over. So really the best swings that you make are the ones that you pull hook. Those are the most natural movements. So if you were to rotate your hand, I don't know what it is, a quarter of an inch. I don't know. I'd have to check to see what it is. You want the heel of your left hand on the top of the club. The last three fingers are underneath. The heel of the hand is just about even with the right side of the shaft. It's just about even with the right side of the shaft. Now you have equal pressure with the heel of the hand and the last three fingers. So the heel of the hand is pressing down into the shaft, into the grip. The last three fingers are pressing up. So you have equal pressure on both sides. And you have equal pressure on the left and right. So right now, your left hand is not creating equal pressure on the golf club relative to the club face with your left hand. The right hand may be. If the right hand is on square and the left hand is on strong, then I would think that your hands separate a bit, either up at the top of the backswing, down through impact, or certainly at the finish. Is that the case for you?
Yeah, I would say that's right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the reason is because your hands can't fit together because one is rotated in a different manner than the other. So, I mean, why do you have your right hand on in a what would be a square position? Why would you do that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, my right hand is square because that's where I want the club face, you know, I'm trying to make sure the club face comes square on the way down. Now, it makes sense to me what you're saying is since the hands naturally want to finish, both hands want to finish square, that yeah. That is, you know, now that's why I'm inconsistent because I got to time it right.
Yeah, a lot of times right-handed people, they have their most awareness with their right side. Right. So I see that pretty often, actually. What kind of golfer are you, Chris?
I'm a 12.
The 70?
No, okay. I'm a low 80s, mid 80s player.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. So generally, you know, right hand golfers have a lot of awareness in space where their right hand is. So it's like right hand club face, and their left hand isn't as educated. It's not as smart. It's not as aware. So they put their left hand on very often any which way. You know, sometimes it's weak and that person fights a fake. If it's on a little bit strong, they fight a hook. So all we have to do is really get their hands so that the palms of their hands face each other. And all of a sudden it's like the club face does not want to come back to close now. Doesn't want to. So the hook has been eliminated. A draw, you can still draw the ball, but you can't hook it, which is mind-boggling for many people that have been fighting a hook their entire lives.
There you go. Arm raised in the air.
They put that thing on there and they make a swing and they, you know, their right hand is like still searching for the squareness, but the left isn't messing things up. So the ball, you know, generally goes out forward. Now the left hand has to figure out how to come into impact properly. But, you know, if you're fighting a hook, pull hook and shooting 85, I mean, my goodness. I mean, why wouldn't you be? Why, if you stop hooking the ball, what would you shoot?
Right.
Probably five shots better. I don't know. I mean, you got to make a bogey, a few bogeys, maybe a double bogey every round, maybe a couple double bogeys every round. You probably make about, I don't know. I'd be guessing you're probably making 10 pars, 11 pars a day. And then the other stuff is like, well, it's not that bad. And you make a couple bogeys. And then there's always like four or five holes that's where you're really your bad score. That's where you're 85.
100%.
So if you can eliminate the worst shot that a player creates for themselves, then all of a sudden it's like, you got to be kidding me. I don't have to deal with this issue on a golf course anymore. You mean I could actually go through it in an aggressive manner the way my personality is and I want to, you know, rip it out there and I'm not worried about hitting it over in the water or in the desert or in the rock or the trees over to my left? Or, you know, anybody that hooks it hits a high push right. Everybody does that because they get tired of, they can't hit it left on that ball. And then they push it off to the right somewhere. So over time, you eliminate both those things so that the ball generally goes down the golf course. Now, at a high level, if your starting position, all the aspects of the starting position, and your loading motion is pretty good, your unload is pretty good, all of a sudden, the swing goes down the fairway, or the swing goes down a portion of the fairway. You know, high-level golfers, they go down slivers of the fairway. But for an amateur golfer, it's like if you're a good athlete and you work on your game, if you're a fundamental player, you do these time-tested fundamentals, going from 85 to, I don't know, 77 to 80 is like, it's as soon as you can get used to getting your grip on that way and hitting a number of balls. I don't know how many balls it's going to take you. You know, sometimes people do it in the first shot. Sometimes it takes 150 balls to actually get them to realize what their hands and their body has to do through impact to get it to behave properly. So I never know when that's going to happen, but it's 100%. You know, for my long-term students, it's literally 100% success rate.
You got me excited to get out on the range. I got to promise you that. I can't wait to see what that does.
Marvelous.
Bob, let's bring it home and put it all together. Oftentimes, you know, we get so mechanical. You talk about swing thoughts and that sort of thing. We get overwhelmed. How do we take what you're teaching, like this piece with the grip and then the mental approach? How do we kind of put it all together and then go out and get started?
Well, you know, to be an accomplished golfer, there's really four things that you have to do. And this would be kind of like in the mind map that we talked about in the center of our page. Okay. So you want to have a great starting position. You want to have a great finishing position. You want to have the ability to repeat the rhythm or what I call the beat of your swing. You have to be able to repeat the beat and you have to do these things within balance. So in like a one sentence golf swing, okay, golf swing. Oh my God, books have been written. I'm going to put the golf swing in one sentence for you. The starting position connects to the finishing position within the confines and protection of beat and balance, rhythm and balance. Start, finish, beat, balance. Okay? So you go, okay, I'll buy into that. So how do I get a great starting position? Well, the most basic component of the starting position is the absolute best grip in the world. So in order to have a great starting position, you have to have a great grip. Okay. So in order to have a finishing position, the most basic component of the finishing position, wherever your left foot is at address, whatever angle that creates, whatever space that's in, you want to occupy that space at the finish. So the most basic component of the starting position is the grip. The most basic component of the finishing position is the stability of the left foot. So start, finish, beat, balance. So I would get my students to master those four things first. Start, finish, beat, balance. Now most people bring me, they repeat their beat. They just swing at an angle relative to their target that is way off. So they can't anticipate the results. So we start with that. So that would be the center of our page and we work out and then we come back. So the greatest players in the world have the most stable and basic things. They have mastered these basic fundamentals of the golf swing. And you can go on the mental side and the learning side as well. But that's what I get all my students to do. A proper starting position allows for the desired result. The proper finishing position assures the desired result.
Fantastic. Bob, let our listeners know, how can they stay up to date with you? Check out your website. How can they find you online? Find you on social media? And more importantly, find you to come get some lessons.
Well, you can go to bobbymangolf.com or go to golfschool.com and you can have the greatest golf learning experience of your life. I mean, I love to have anybody who wishes to learn. Doesn't matter, right, left-handed, male, female, young, older. And we're out here in sunny Las Vegas and ready for you.
And remind them the name of your book and where they can get a copy of it.
It's called The Absolute Best Grip in the World: How to Finally Take Control of Your Golf Game. And that is on Amazon. Just type in my name, Bob Byman, go on Amazon Books, and it'll be right there.
Bob, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy schedule to come back and be a part of this show. You're fantastic, my friend. I'm telling you, you got me excited. I can't wait to get out on the practice range, change that grip up, and see the great things it's going to do for my golf swing and my ball flight. Can't thank you enough for that tip, and like I say, your time today.
You bet, Chris. It was a pleasure. I'll tell you, the hour went by very, very quickly, didn't it? I love talking to you. Thank you so much.
I appreciate you. Bob, take care. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up again soon.
Bye, Chris. Take care.
See you, Bob.
That was Bob Byman. B-Y-M-A-N is the spelling of his last name. Again, the title of the book, The Absolute Best Grip in the World, How to Finally Take Control of Your Game. I promise you, I can't wait to try out the grip change that he and I just talked about. You can follow him online at bobbymangolf.com and also lessons at gotogolfschool.com. Folks, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day to continue to make Next on the Tee a part of your golfing content. You can subscribe to the show on every major podcast app. I'll be back in a few weeks to kick off season number 9 of the show. Until then, hit 'em straight, my friends.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.